Hi folks, welcome to the Money 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 podcast. I'm Surabhi Upadhyay and we come to you every week with some very interesting conversations to help you get your personal finances in order and get smart with your money. FY19 was a roller coaster year for all of us investors, including the super rich. Credit market rumblings, equity market volatility, and election uncertainty meant tepid returns and even losses in some cases. But all that is a thing of the past now. With hope of an economic revival and a strong majority government back in power, what will FY20 have in store for the HNI investor? What is the right asset class mix? What are the hot products that one can perhaps look at? And what is the risk mitigation strategy for this year? That's the most important question. We're going to be raising a lot of these issues with my guests on the show this week. Anshu Kapoor, Head Edelweiss Private Wealth Management, and Gaurav Avasthi, Senior Partner at IIFL Wealth Management. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining in. It's an interesting theme. It's, you know, once in a while we do look at what the super rich are also up to. But before we get down to the plan for this year, I think the last year was a very interesting one, Anshu. What were the highlights for you? What were the lessons? Were there sleepless nights? What was the risk mitigation plan?
Thank you. Thank you, Surabhi. Great to be here. Well, as you rightly said, the last year was very, very eventful. And it was actually a tale of two halves. Until the beginning of September, I think everything was going very well. Mm. All asset classes were performing fairly well. Mm-hmm. And what happened afterwards, I don't think many of our clients or investors were actually prepared for. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you a couple of observations. Number one, what we've seen is because the bull run was going on for so long, we saw the signs of asset allocation being broken in most portfolios. Uh-huh. In equities, one, we saw skewness beyond what was necessary in client portfolios, mm-hmm. towards what you call higher risk.
So mid-caps and small-caps.
Yeah, so within equities, there are two or three things we saw. Mm-hmm. One, over-allocation to perhaps mid-caps or small-caps. Mm-hmm. Two, in some cases, use of leverage. Uh-huh. And three, accessing these opportunities through locked-in products or solutions. Okay. So where there's either a very heavy exit cost, mm-hmm. or it's not possible to exit.
When you say locked-in solutions, what exactly do you mean?
It could be funds. Mm-hmm. You're accessing the listed markets, but you're going through a locked-in product. Mm. And therein lies the dilemma, because if it is a mid-cap, small-cap, and if you see a drawdown and you need the money, you have a cost that is inflicted upon you. Mm-hmm. In fixed income, I think clients realize the difference between fixed income and credit.
So I think fixed income is going to be a separate conversation.
Correct.
Just hold on for a second, because I'm going to come back to it. It's going to take a lot of our time. Also, you mentioned leverage in equities. Where were leverage levels, let's say, when the crisis hit us around September, October, and where are they today?
I think, I must say, they were not obscene. Mm-hmm. But in selected portfolios, we did see the use of leverage to enhance returns. Mm-hmm. This could be participating in specific opportunities that came in the markets, or it could be complete leverage over on the portfolio. Okay. So I would not say that it was excessive, mm-hmm. but in portfolios, it did cause destruction. Okay. Because when leverage hits and the markets are going down, you are a forced seller.
Absolutely.
And if you're a forced seller, you end up selling the best assets first or the
because
most liquid
the most
assets
liquid,
first.
Yes, yes.
And then you come down to what you should have ideally sold.
Sure.
So
sure,
that was a concern that we saw. Mm-hmm. Today, I don't think there's any leverage.
We do this, not we're still talking the equity part of the portfolio.
Yes, the equity part of the portfolio.
Okay, so it's become fairly light.
Yes.
All right, Gaurav, I want to get your anecdotes and your lessons from FY19 as well.
So I think the key lesson remains that you have to, you know, hold firm to portfolio allocation and, you know, read the signals properly. Mm-hmm. So while the events happened in September, but the signals were there from January itself to see what was happening. Because even in January, if you'll go back on the equity side, the valuations were very high. In fact, our asset allocation model was talking about a zero allocation to mid-caps, small-caps, the way the valuations were.
But were clients listening?
So that was the, you know, pitch that we had gone back to clients and said that, you know, this is the time to take off risk. Mm. But unfortunately, you know, from a mental perspective, I think people are more attuned to, you know, adjusting themselves to last year returns and hoping that, you know, it will, or last 3 years returns and hoping it will carry forever. Mm. And if you look at the same signs were there in the credit market also. You know, while credit is a very dirty word today, but if you go back in January, you were not really getting bang for the buck in credit.
And this, we're talking January of 2018, by the way, let me remind you, not 2019, yeah. because we're just rewinding the clock to try and understand where things started going wrong, so those mistakes are not repeated. Please continue.
Yeah, so if you go back, the spreads were not attractive. Mm-hmm. You know, the kind of returns that you were getting for the kind of risk that you were taking was not matching. So, in fact, our call were, most of last year was to stay in AAA and probably in the shorter end. Mm-hmm. If you look at the basic reason for both of this was liquidity chasing. Credit funds had done extremely well before that. So there was a lot of money that was going on pumping credit funds, and those guys had to buy whatever is the rate. And I think the same is the case for mid-caps, small-caps. Mm. Because the past few returns, years' returns were extremely good and people were chasing, and the liquidity eventually, you know, ended in September, and you see where the party popped.
Sure, absolutely. So now I want to talk about sort of what happened with the credit market, Anshu, in a little more detail, because not only did we have the IL&FS event and, you know, the market kind of was frozen for about a month, month and a half, what we saw thereafter was this entire promoter funding issue, loan against shares becoming a bit of a problem, NBFCs and housing finance companies, and that kind of stress started coming through the system. What did that mean for HNI portfolios on the debt side?
Well, as I said earlier, the difference between fixed income and credit. Mm. And somehow clients or investors thought that all components of fixed income and credit are like principal protected, that I will get my money back. Mm-hmm. See, credit events happen once in a while, mm. but when they happen, they are very severe. And the last one we saw was about 10 years back, right? And there, credit really, really shows up in portfolios. Unfortunately, the way the tax advantages are set up, it is tax efficient for clients to invest in a three-year kind of a product in fixed income, credit.
Yes.
See, if credit is priced well, there is no problem taking that risk. Mm. If it is not priced well in any structure, it will show up as a problem. Mm. And what really, really has happened is underlying the mutual fund structures or the FMPs or the fixed income funds, in some cases, it is not priced well. Mm. Some of these loans, if they were given out to any of these entities at 14, 15, 16%, for example, you're pricing that risk of potential default.
Sure.
But when you price that risk at 9, 10, 11%, that is not the right pricing of the risk. Mm. That is what went wrong.
Okay.
And then, because, see, 60, 70% of most ultra-high net worth clients is fixed income.
Exactly. And if there are problems in that part of the portfolio, that's
a absolutely.
Huge risk.
And if you're chasing a little bit extra for so much more, there's a problem in the portfolio. Mm. And this is the realization which happened to most clients or investors later on as the crisis played out.
Sure.
But risk is a big element. Now there is awareness even on fixed income, which was not earlier there. We always thought equity is risky.
Yeah.
But now there is a lot more conversation around risk in fixed income.
And it's astounding, because when we speak to a lot of our retail viewers, we keep re-emphasizing that point. But yes, it's an eye-opener that even the ultra HNIs can get it wrong when it comes to fixed income if you're not prudent with your strategy. Now, with the lessons of the past with us, what is the situation looking like? Because it's still uncertain. I mean, we still do not know that there's a certain arrangement in place. September, certain payments are supposed to happen with a particular corporate group. I'm talking about, of course, the Z Group. Given this whole context, given the new NBFC regulations that are being spoken of, what are you telling clients to do in fixed income?
So first of all, let's understand the size of the problem. The size is not very large, Surabhi, because, you know, individual, you know, issues aside, but see, the total size of NPA in India is about $200 billion. So give or take, if you add a few billion dollars here or there, it is not a massive problem, first of all, for anyone to solve. Hmm. One, we expect that liquidity will return. The government, we believe, is fairly, fairly aware of the issues, and liquidity should come back. Individual cases in individual funds or investments, you will see some delays or defaults, but it will not be really, really destructive.
For instance, this FMP situation that kind of arose, where suddenly investors realize that you can also lose your principal. There can be capital loss,
correct,
not just losing out the interest.
Yeah.
So what is your analysis of this situation, and how do you look at FMPs as a product now?
So mostly, I think all the risks are now priced in. Mm-hmm. And obviously, if investors are locked into some of these FMPs, there is no immediate exit. Exit will be possible as and when these issues are resolved. So that the investors have to live with. That is a risk that has been quantified and defined. But going forward, as I said, things should ease out from here. But more than that, I think there's an awareness of the entire, there's a lot of conversation going on around this subject, and people are actually reviewing the portfolios. So if you see the outflows from the fixed income market, they are representative of that awareness. And obviously there's a risk off approach right now. Clients actually have swung from one end of the risk pendulum to the other end of the risk pendulum. The other problem that happened and that compounded was that, what is AAA? How do I have the confidence that a company or an issue, a security is AAA?
With something that was AAA yesterday is junk this morning.
Yes.
Suddenly you wake
so
up. Yeah.
Given all of that happened, there is still a flight to risk off or to safety. It will take time for the markets to normalize. And moreover,
so what should clients do now? What's the advice?
I think, as I said earlier, if you are taking credit risk, take credit risk. If you are getting into fixed income, which is conservative, preservation and income oriented, do not take that risk.
Okay.
So that is number one. And if you want to access credit markets, there are a lot of other products available.
Okay.
Where you are compensated for the risk that you take.
Okay.
And I think that's where most clients are getting into. But right now, there's overall a huge, huge kind of microscopic analysis of fixed income, the way perhaps I have not seen the last 10 years happening.
Sure.
On
and maybe for good reason, and maybe for all our betterment as we go down the road. But Gaurav, your thoughts on the fixed income market, same questions and what you are telling clients now.
See, essentially, in every crisis, there is an opportunity. So one was that from our perspective, we never thought that mutual funds are possibly the best places to pay credit because of the fact that credit in a lot of places was mispriced, and also the structure of the underlying deals in a lot of cases, the MF managers were not in complete control because these were large deals, there were multiple parties. So I think for us, for a core part of the portfolio where you don't want to take risk, you remain in a, AAA short-term variety where you're not really taking too much credit risk, you are, in a PSU kind of format. But I think the part of the portfolio where you actually want to gain returns by taking risk, it is far better to go into, maybe alternate investment funds, where you have structured deals, deal sizes are 100, 200 crores, you have complete, control over the underlying, you are the sole lender. So there, even if there is a problem, your ability to control and manage the problem is far better. And B, you are getting far more bang for the buck. In a format like that.
So don't get too cute with your fixed income investment. Let it lie in a short-term fund. And if you're looking to create a certain amount of higher return, then look at alternatives. Which brings me to the next question. Within alternatives, what are the trends that you're noticing? And what kind of AIFs, what kind of funds are perhaps good for this year?
So I think looking at the volatility of both the equity and fixed income markets, people have realized that you cannot really try the same strategy in AIFs that you will do in conventional equity, because there is no point. So as I said, on the credit side, obviously there are specialized funds that are coming. I think a lot of people are also now interested in
some examples of these specialized credit funds, because we just want to understand the new products and make sure that obviously they're relatively safe as well.
So IFL itself has a credit opportunities fund which we have launched in the market, and we have already raised close to 1,000 crores in the fund. Plus, there are other players in the market which are also raising credit funds at this point of time. I think on the other side also, people have realized that the portfolio just of listed equity, gives you enough volatility. If you really want to move away, diversify this portfolio, you also have to get into a lot of private equity space.
Okay.
And, for example, a company like Flipkart is already valued at $22 billion, which has never hit the public market, and you don't know when it will hit. And today it is as large from a valuation perspective as a lot of companies in Nifty. So I think a lot of people are trying to now, are looking interested in the space, which is in the private market, I think, which is platform-driven, which is technology-driven. And looking to diversify their core risk or equity exposure away from the public market also.
Okay, all right. So, Anshu, your thoughts here? If I want to move away from a regular short-term fund or a bond fund, look at alternatives, then how to do this?
Yeah, sure. So, obviously, client wealth has grown in the last 10 years, and so has the need for more solutions. One of the conversations we are driving with clients is that, how can you introduce solutions in your portfolio where the risk return is not linked to directly correlated to equity markets or to interest rates? And that is the realm of alternatives. Mm-hmm. And globally, actually, it is mainstream. Mm-hmm. We call it alternatives, but globally, it is mainstream. Mm-hmm. And like Gaurav said, private markets, for example. Private debt, globally, if you remember, after 2008, a lot of investment banks gave their prop lending, and they moved to fund structures. So credit creation started to happen through asset management and not through balance sheets. I think that's a trend that will increasingly play out in India. And we've been trying to be at the forefront of that trend. So a lot of access through private credit will happen.
Okay.
And through asset management platforms where there is no ALM risk.
Okay.
So I'm just maybe combining the whole liquidity, NBFC, and the opportunity for the clients.
Okay.
So globally, because it's a large market and it's proven to be quite worthy of investments. So private markets, alternatives, in alternatives now.
But private credit, I mean, just to ask another question over here. We're talking about not private equity, but really private on the credit side. It's something that's not really typically picked up in India so far.
Yes.
So are you seeing new platforms? What is happening? Are we going to see something this year?
Absolutely. So like Gaurav said, there are a couple of funds already available in the market. We've been investing in private credit for a fairly long time as Edelweiss. And we also have opportunities and solutions for clients in the AIF route there, where instead of the balance sheet growing, we contribute as Edelweiss to the fund. And therefore, we also have a skin in the game and clients invest in the fund.
Okay.
And that's a proven what you call the LPGP model.
LPGP, okay.
Yeah, limited partner.
Okay.
So that's a proven model. But just step aside a little bit from private credit. You have distressed assets funds. You have infrastructure yielding funds.
How have the distressed funds, because I remember when we had the same conversation a year ago, you did mention that obviously for obvious reasons, stressed assets and special situation funds would be something to look at. A year down the line, what are returns looking like and what's the prospect for FY20?
I think returns we will see over the next 3 to 5 years. But I must say that we, for example, raised about $1 billion. It's fairly large for one fund in the country. It's one of the largest in the country. So we are seeing an increasing amount of interest to diversify away from the regular asset allocation. Then obviously you've had the real estate credit funds. So the whole, the ladder is, you start with the basic private credit, then you maybe go up to real estate credit, which increases risk a little bit, and maybe you go up to the distressed assets. And somewhere in between is the infrastructure yielding assets. So these are all global proven model. I think those are now making their own space in the Indian context.
Bankers would be extremely happy to know that there's more and more money being raised in these funds, because then some of the lending can move to this side of the market and not necessarily be completely hinged on NBFCs or banks. So gentlemen, I want to now also talk about real estate. Ends up being a much loved and much hated asset class at the same time. Gaurav, what is, first of all, your prognosis? Are we, from an investor's point of view, is there going to be a turnaround this year or not?
See, it appears difficult because if you look at purely from a valuation perspective, see, globally, in most countries, real estate, the rental yields and the interest rates are similar. In India, the gap is very big and it has historically been very big. Now, presumably, you could earlier think about it that, this gap is there because there is prevalence of so much black money, et cetera, which all today is reducing. I think the second factor for real estate is inflation. You know, typically it is an inflation hedged asset. Now, across the last few years, there is no inflation that is really happening. So unless you you start believing that this is country, you are again going to see a lot of inflation that is coming up. Plus, you see rental yields moving up. Otherwise, from a pure price point of view, I don't really see too much upside from here.
So you're not advising investors to really put their money there?
From an investment point of view, no.
Okay, Anshu, your thoughts? Because I mean, I also get the counter argument that, let's say, office spaces, co-working, some of these areas where an HNI can actually invest, they probably are much better off. We're not talking residential real estate here. So just your thoughts.
So Surbhi, first of all, most of the ultra high net worth clients are over-allocated anyways historically to real estate. This is historical, intergenerational land holdings, there's real estate, residential, and there's commercial. So anyways, there's over-allocation. And they're also stuck with liquidity. on the last 5, 7, 8 years, actually, you've not been able to liquidate and
monetize
see returns.
These assets, yes.
So
yes.
That is the other problem. So anyways, in the portfolio, it is not, it is very heavy on the
it's
portfolio.
It's sitting like a block, yeah.
Yeah, and you can say, oh, I don't look at my real estate, but it's part of your asset allocation. So having said that, I think there are interesting opportunities for, because there's a lot of new wealth that is getting created. And increasingly, we see the trend or the preference to go in a financial way, access real estate, rather than, you know, just
holding
go and
that
buy,
block of
buy
land
something,
or,
because then the risk is too high and the monetization is very hard and all.
Yes,
so REITs are a great, great opportunity for clients to look at.
Only one launch this year.
We will see
how
more.
How do you assess the product, and is that something, I mean, how do you look at the returns from the one particular that we have in the market?
Yeah, so I think, first of all, we should understand that globally, REITs are one of the largest holders of commercial real estate. And it's a great way for clients to access income generation and also some amount of capital appreciation. So we will start to see that trend as we go along. And I think, you know, it is still to play out in terms of returns, because it's just one concept that has come. But it's a good concept, I must say.
But how much return would you pencil in if you tell someone to, you
know, invest in this
REIT?
So I would say anywhere between 8 to 12%, given how the economic cycle plays. And on a fixed income portfolio, that's a good pre-tax return anyways in the inflation environment that we are in. In the interest rate environment that we are headed into. And as I said, that more options will come up. And this is a great opportunity for us to start considering the other opportunities like co-working and all. In fact, a lot of our clients are saying, can I give up my residential apartments for co-working, or my commercial, can I, you know, change the whole model and all. And a lot of private equity is coming in. So these are all new trends that are coming in. But having said all of that, unless construction revives in this country, you, because real estate is a huge driver of rural employment and also the ancillary sectors. So I do believe the government should take steps towards that.
To revive real
estate.
We
need construction to revive. Asset inflation, or, you know, fiscal benefits, anything else that you need, we have to see a revival.
Okay, I think some amount of risk appetite as and when it keeps coming back, I think the conversations will resume. Gentlemen, thank you very much. This was a very interesting conversation for sure. Thanks for joining in and sharing these insights with us. That's it on this week's podcast. You can catch the show at 6:30 p.m. on Tuesdays, with repeats on Saturday and Sunday mornings, only on CNBC TV 18. You can also find us on the CNBC TV 18 YouTube channel. Do send your feedback, comments, queries. Catch me on Twitter. My handle is at Surabhi Upadhyay. That's S-U-R-A-B-H-I-U-P-A-D-H-Y-A-Y. Don't forget to add the hashtag money. Catch you next week.